So as far as pre-show, there's not really anything huge on my list here to talk about. I don't have any movie updates for you.
Nah, man.
So we might just jump straight into it.
Welcome back to the Camera Gear Podcast. I'm Daniel.
And I'm Lucas.
And we're back to talk more about the gear side of photo and video. Cool. So we just got back from doing an extended shoot that lasted a couple of days. And I thought that'd be interesting to talk about and go through what we brought, what we thought about it, and kind of how we approached the whole thing. So do you want to kind of introduce what we did?
Yeah, so it was a really fun event, and we're mostly probably going to talk about maybe some of the gear interview setups and what we're doing. Maybe we'll talk about how haunted the house was, or maybe that's a story for another time. But we went out and shot the Big Bend Road Race, which is a race for mostly anyone to enter. Like you have to pay the fee, make sure you have your car in good condition and et cetera. And there's different, you know, categories of, you know, speeds that you could run. And you are racing from Fort Stockton, Texas to Sanderson, Texas. And it's about 59 miles each way. And then each way it's a leg and they average the pace. And a bunch of people come out to compete and most of them drive Corvettes.
Like 80% of them drive Corvettes.
Yeah, there's a lot of Corvettes. Like too many Corvettes. Anyway, so we had a friend who was racing in this event, and we wanted to go out and get a lot of footage of his car and the race and basically make a promotional documentary to, you know, advertise the race and also kind of promote it for him for memory and that sort of thing. So we went out with him on Wednesday for registration, and then we, you know, collected a lot of shots from Wednesday through Sunday, and then Wednesday through Saturday, and then the race was on Saturday, and we got as much stuff from the race as we could. One of the big challenges was that we couldn't be on the course or even at the starting or finish line for the race. And so it was a lot of collecting footage and audio and interviews and all this stuff from around the race. And so I kind of thought it'd be interesting to talk about, you know, how are we going to create, you know, this documentary that is about a race that we couldn't actually capture.
Yeah, that was definitely a challenge. And I mean, I feel like what we did started well before we actually left on the trip. You know, we did some pre-work and figuring out what we were going to have access to. We looked at the schedule to kind of understand what types of events there were going to be. We did some of our own thinking about what kind of project we wanted to make, what story we wanted to tell. And then we even contacted the race coordinator to find out, you know, where are we going to be able to be? What will we have access to? Can we fly drones there? That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like doing all that definitely informed the type of gear we brought and sort of how we approached it. I mean, you can only tell the story that you have access to tell. And so that affected everything we brought.
You know, if with any kind of documentary type thing, you can plan as much as, you know, time you have available. But at the end of the day, you don't really know what's going to happen, what you're going to shoot, what you're going to have an opportunity to get. So with that in mind, I mean, we did everything we could to prepare, and then we, you know, packed out our camera rigs. And so, you know, maybe we should run through, you know, all the gear that we brought to this thing.
Well, I guess for me, I mean, I brought my standard camera, which is a Fuji X-H2S.
Uh-huh.
A couple of lenses. So I brought all three of the lenses I have, which is the Tamron 17-70. The Fuji 50-140 and the Sigma 30. And out of those, I think I ended up using the first two. So I didn't use the Sigma at all.
Mm.
Just kind of the way it worked out. That was my main camera setup. Do you want to go through this per item, or do you want me to just go down like everything I brought? What do you think is...
Yeah, well, I guess the categories, you covered camera and lenses. Mm-hmm. So each of us brought a subset of the things that we needed, which was camera gear, audio gear, and lighting. So that was your camera gear. What right. I brought was the same camera, but then I brought a backup camera. So I had the X-H2S and then I had the X-T3. And I was using the X-T3 mostly to capture photos while we were moving from place to place. And then the X-H2S was essentially my video camera for the shoot. And then whenever we did the interview, we used the X-T3 as for our three-point setup, which it'd be good to talk about that setup. And I brought way too many lenses. I brought my Canon 70-200, like just in case we needed some sort of long shot, like maybe we were going to be able to set up close to the start line or the finish line, and like I needed to be able to get some car shots from a distance. And so I brought it. That thing was so heavy and it took up so much space in my bag, and I didn't touch it one time. So that was unfortunate. But I used every other lens I brought, which was the same zoom as you, that 17-70. It's a fantastic zoom. I'm really happy that they brought that to Fuji. I'm looking forward to see what else Tamron brings over. Hoping like they need to drop a wide angle zoom. Like they have the telephoto coming out later, but they need to finish out that three.
Yeah,
anyways.
Yeah.
They said they were going to do it. And like, is it going to happen? I don't know. I got to replace that lens. I mean, I don't have to. But like, anyways, it's not important. I brought that zoom. And then I also brought my 85mm Viltrox and the 30mm Sigma 1.4.
How much did you end up using those primes?
I left the 30mm on the X-T3 the entire time. So almost all of my pictures were taken on the 30mm. Because it's a real nice, you know, walking around lens. It's not quite telephoto. It's not quite wide. It's just right in the middle. I still think that maybe I would prefer the 23-1.4 over it, but I know that a lot of people have a lot of opinions about that 35mm full frame equivalent, and having never owned anything in that range, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it would be too much, like, eyesight. I do like long lenses. Anyway, not important. I took a lot of pictures with it, not a lot of video. I use the 85, just really, I think I only use that for the close-up shots in our interview setup. Where the two tights, I had the 85 and then you had the 50-140 on the XH2S. So yeah.
I really found that I was using the 17-70 almost the whole time. And I brought that 50-140, which I just recently got. And I had kind of imagined that I'd be able to get a bunch of, you know, really close up shots. And, you know, especially if we had been able to be on the race course, I thought that was going to be really ideal to get those sorts of, you know, close angles on the cars and stuff. But that 17-70 is a really good range, and it, you know, if you zoom all the way into 70, that's pretty punched in on APS-C.
It is,
and it just kind of ended up that the situations we were in, I was able to get close enough to things that I didn't often need that extra reach. And I mean, you can't really know that going into it. I'm glad I had the longer lens available, but I just didn't end up needing it all that much. And if anything, I felt like I needed more wide shots than I got. So it was nice having the wide option.
Yeah, it's so tempting to always get those low depth of field tight shots to fill out all your B-roll, and then you forget to get your establishing stuff. And so that was a lot of like the last day was after going through the footage, like, oh no, we need to get a lot of wide stuff now in order to fill that out, which I guess when you're shooting it, it's like you always got to think, okay, I'm in this location, give me a tight, medium, wide at this exact spot. And like that gives you your options, and then you move on and anchor your next shot.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, the 50-140 is such a fantastic lens. I mean, I borrowed that from you to shoot a 2-year-old's birthday party. And I mean, looking at the photos from that and then looking at the photos from the Sigma 30 Prime and comparing the two, they are almost identical in sharpness. And it's pretty incredible the detail that you can get out of that. You know, telephoto zoom.
Yeah, I mean, something that is a pretty fast lens, a pretty wide range, and internal zoom. You know, all three of those together, that's a great lens.
I think that you should put it on a gimbal and just see what happens.
It would be so heavy.
You'd be like Michael Bay. You get so much parallax effect.
That would be pretty cool.
Just think about it.
That would be pretty cool.
You can get so much really cool B-roll. Yeah. I don't know what you would shoot of it, but it would be amazing.
So I want to talk a lot more about our strategy from shooting and stuff, but I guess let's go through some of the rest of the gear.
Yeah, let's run through the rest of the gear. So that was all the camera gear that I brought. And then I brought the Mavic Air 2. And then I brought my Zoom for capturing audio. And then I brought a shotgun mic and a lav mic and the Rode video mic. Just way too many mics.
And what of those did you end up really using?
I didn't use the lav. I basically brought the lav only as a physical backup to those DJI mics that you were bringing. And I used the shotgun for capturing audio of the car on the road. And I used it, you know, from the car and while set up on the side of the road to capture audio. And then I used it as B-roll backup. B-roll backup?
B-roll backup.
Yeah. I used it as backup for the interview.
Okay, yeah.
B mic is what I was going for.
As far as audio stuff for me, I brought my Zoom recorder to get general environmental sounds, and then if we needed it for the interview. I did end up using that some for a couple of times where I wanted to capture really good audio of something.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I don't trust the camera preamps, but just feel like the Zoom does a little bit better. And it's also just less file size. So if you want to record audio for 10 minutes or something, I sure would rather record that on the Zoom than record a 4K 60 clip of that audio. So I used that a few times.
You did do that towards the end there, right?
Well, yeah. And I did it because it was what I had available at the time. And that's kind of an interesting thing about that shooting is that, you know, if you have all the time in the world, it's like, it's great to be able to have all the right equipment, you know, and like, I'm recording audio now, so I need the Zoom and the microphone and stuff. But with doing this documentary stuff, that's not always how it goes, you know, and sometimes the thing is happening and you're there and you need to capture it. And so the mic that I used most was a Rode video mic. Mm-hmm. So not the micro, but the video mic, which is a larger shotgun style mic, but it still fits on a cold shoe. So I had it on the camera cage and I used that almost the whole time to get B-roll audio. But what I ended up doing is I would be with my camera shooting things that were happening. And the people that we were capturing were talking about things that I thought would be good to have in the video. And so I would just hit record on the camera, point the mic at them, and just let it go, whether I was getting good video or not. And so it's... Man, you got to calm that thing down.
I don't know how to make it be silent. It's That's the find the phone thing.
Yeah.
Which one is it?
The bell.
Is it the bell?
Yeah, it's the bell.
That doesn't make any sense. Okay, I figured it out. My watch is now quiet, even though my phone was already quiet. And yes, I'm good.
I don't remember what I was saying, but yeah. So basically, I would use that to get audio sometimes, you know, even if I didn't have that Zoom with me. Because most of the time I was walking around with the camera, I didn't have the Zoom in my hand. And so sometimes I would just record the camera and get the audio from it that way. But I use that on-camera mic a lot because... It's great to have B-roll audio of things that you're filming. And so I was really prioritizing that. And every time I was filming, I was trying to do long enough clips that I could get good audio from it and make that work.
Plus, we had to get as many car sounds as we could. We are going to have to go back and record more car sounds. But, you know, getting as much as we could in the B-roll is pretty helpful.
Yeah, yeah. Anything that I feel like it's like you want things that define the environment, you know, like in this case, it's a race. So like you want a lot of car sounds.
Yeah. And you can always, you know, sub in some pre-recorded sound stuff for that. But it really is better if you just have it or you collected it on scene, you know, bring it in.
Yeah. So I brought that. And then for the interview, I brought the DJI mics and that's what we used as the main interview audio. So we've covered those in the past, but you know, just a really great wireless lav. And that's what we used for the interview.
Neither of us mentioned the small HD monitors that we both brought and didn't use.
Yeah, yeah. I was trying to remember, and I think I used mine for the interview.
We did. We set up both of them for the interview.
Yeah, so normally I love shooting on a monitor, and when we shoot events, most of the time I'll rig out my camera with the top handle and the monitor, and I like having that bigger screen, and I feel like the focus peaking is a little bit better, and I just prefer using it. It's nice. And I brought it on this trip because I thought for sure I'm going to use that. This is a really important project. I want to do a good job on it. And I didn't use it at all. And the reason I didn't use it was because I never had time to rig it up. So I had it in my backpack. And what it always would end up as is we would get to a spot and people would be moving around doing stuff and I wanted to capture it. And I just needed to be able to grab my camera and go as quickly as I could. And the monitor just didn't fit into that at all. So I just didn't use it.
Yeah, and then also it's fairly sunny, and those small HD 5 inches go up to 1,000 nits. But even in that case, it's kind of better to just use the eyepiece.
Yeah, I actually found the other day they come with a sunshade.
Yeah,
or at least mine did, and I meant to bring it, and I totally forgot it. So maybe that would have helped a little bit, but it just makes the whole thing bulkier. And you know, if you're in a situation where you're going to be jumping in and out of a car all the time or whatever you're doing, it's just it's kind of ungainly. So
right. And like, really it kind of makes sense if you just have the camera with you and like, it's all rigged up and ready to go. But a lot of what we were doing was like, okay, we're going to shoot, load it into your backpack, and then we're going to go from here to there. And then here to there might be 30 minutes because it's West Texas.
Yeah.
And then now you have to take the stuff back out and maybe
you're piling in the vehicle with a bunch of other people or a bunch of gear. And I mean, the whole time you're there for a reason and everybody's supporting what you're doing. But at the same time, you don't want to be dragging the whole thing down.
Right. You don't want to be in the way. You don't want to always be rigging something up. You need to be there ready and not the person that people are waiting on.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the monitor just didn't fit into that workflow very well. And so I did everything with the camera and it was fine. You also mentioned that it was sunny outside, and we're going to talk about that a lot more later, I think. But that also brings up that I use the eyepiece on the camera a lot, which is something that I almost never do. So when we shoot events indoors or something, I typically use the screen on the camera. I like that I can see it from more angles and it's bigger, but out in the sunlight, you can't see that very well. And I was using the eyepiece instead because I was actually able to see what I was shooting. So that was also, for me, a new way that I don't normally use my camera.
That's definitely interesting. I'm a big fan of using the EVF for shooting video. I know that not a lot of people are, and most of your dedicated video cameras don't even have one, like the FX30. But the EVF on the XH2S is double the pixel count of the previous previous camera, yeah. The XT4.
It is very high resolution.
It's a really good EVF.
And we have to point out, it also gives you another point of contact. So if you use the EVF, you can brace the camera against your head, and that can actually stabilize shots. So
it sure can.
It's a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. And it also makes it a little less conspicuous. Like, it looks like you're just taking a picture. And so if you're trying not to get in the way, then, maybe it looks like you're just composing a shot. So
yeah.
We didn't talk about the GoPros, which we also had borrowed two GoPro Hero 11 Black.
That's what they are. It's just Hero 11.
Sorry.
They've gotten rid of all the weird names.
Yeah, I was like, did I say enough words?
Yeah.
Buzz, buzz, buzz. And then I use my iPhone a lot, oddly enough. I mean, I've always been an Android guy, but I bought the 12 a few years ago.
12 Pro Max.
So I bought it specifically because the video on Android is, the Pixel phones or the Samsung's better. But it's not always been great. And everyone's like, oh, well, video on iPhone's fantastic. And so I shot with my iPhone a lot. I was recording some stuff to put together like a vlog type video to go, to publish separately from what we were working on, and then some behind the scenes stuff. And a lot of the behind the scenes stuff I just shot on my iPhone. And I think that footage is going to mix together pretty good. I have found that whenever I do try to mix in iPhone stuff, it's always a little too saturated, and you have to be careful not to accidentally shoot in HDR, because it doesn't, you have to like color space transform it and then take the saturation down by like 80%. It's still cell phone footage, but I mean, it was a nice to have C cam when I was like, oh man, I can't even get my camera out of my bag right now. I'm just going to take my phone in my pocket and shoot it.
Well, and I remember when we were just getting started on this experience, like we were about to leave with the car, you put your phone on the ground facing up, right above the ramp as we were loading the car,
right,
and got a really cool shot of the car getting loaded in. And so sometimes it's like, that's the smallest camera that you can fit into a certain place.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can get shots that way. And even though it doesn't look as good as the bigger camera, in situations like that, sometimes getting any shot is better than not having a shot.
Definitely. Yeah. It's like, don't let the specific camera that you have on hand limit you, and don't think that, we're shooting this whole thing in, F-Log 2 and all this dynamic range and, as a really high bitrate 4K footage, everything's going to look super, super clean. Like, still pick up a bunch of B-roll shots with your phone, because you're going to have more content and it's going to probably mix in fine and no one's going to notice.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to use them if they look bad, but if you have the opportunity, then sure.
Definitely. Get it. And then what about lighting?
So lighting's interesting. I mean, most of the stuff we were doing was extremely run and gun. So all kinds of different locations, not ideal conditions, no time to set things up. And so, I mean, for most of the shooting we did, we didn't use any lights. I had brought my Aputure MCs just in case we found a use for them, but we just didn't need any of that. We didn't have the option to use any of that. But what we did do while we were there was an interview. So I think you briefly touched on that earlier, but as part of this documentary, we wanted to be able to tell the story of what these guys were doing. And it felt like the best way to do that was to interview them one time and get a bunch of information from them and get them to answer a bunch of questions. And then we're going to cut that up later and use some of their answers throughout the video to kind of tell the story.
Right.
And basically have them tell it rather than us explaining things. And so when I first planned it, I thought about doing a bunch of quick interviews, like at various points. We just got to this place. Let's do a quick thing and ask them what we're doing. And I kind of realized maybe like the day before we did it, that was not really a great idea, just because I thought it was going to slow things down too much. And so I thought it'd be better just to do one big interview and do it that way. And in hindsight, I'm really glad we did that, because I think it would have really slowed things down if we had tried to do that as we went. And it also let us control the situation more. So we were able to get a better interview by doing it like on our terms, on our turf, with some ability to set stuff up. But what was still interesting about it was that, you know, we had to drive 6 hours to get to this place. We couldn't take all of our normal equipment and all of our gear. And so we did kind of have to think about what is our minimal setup and how can we get a stripped down interview setup that's still going to look good and still going to work well. And so that's kind of what you're referencing with the lighting. So we used one of the new Aputure Cobb lights, the 60X. So it's a 60-watt LED light, and the 60X is bicolor, so it can go from 2700 to 6500K. And what's really interesting about it is that it's incredibly small. So it's like the smallest light I've ever seen that can use a normal Bowens mount softbox.
It is so small. Like, I knew it was small, but whenever I held it in my hands, it was like a baby light. And I just wanted to look at it and then turn it on and blind myself with its beauty.
Yeah, it's a really cool product. And I fortunately had a 24-inch collapsible softbox just lying around. And so that just paired really well with it. We were able to use a tiny little light stand because the light weighs like nothing, and put that softbox on it, and it's a great little light. It did just fine for what we were doing.
Yep.
And it's so much smaller than what a larger one would be.
I can confirm that it will definitely fit into a Peak Design 45-liter backpack.
I mean, everything will fit in that backpack, but still.
You're not wrong. But having that light on hand and being knowing that, hey, we got to go shoot an interview, that I could load up, you know, enough cameras, lenses, the light stand, and the light, and all the audio equipment just into one bag. That way you're not like bringing in this. I mean, last time we shot an interview, I brought my Godox VL120, which is a fantastic light. And, you know, it's quiet and all this great stuff. But in using that for the interview, we shot it at, you know, I think 40% or 30%. I didn't need a 120-watt light. I could have used a 60-watt light. And that little COB probably would have done just perfect for that. And it was fantastic for this, where we had this tiny little mobile interview setup, but it was still three cameras and mic audio and backup audio and a key light.
Yeah, I mean, it worked great. We were lucky enough that we were able to do it inside, you know, in an Airbnb, so we had power right there. But the other cool thing about that light is that you can power it from two NPF batteries. So
when you said the cool thing about the light, I thought you were going to say the cool thing about the Airbnb was that purple couch.
The purple couch was pretty great, and that worked out really well for that setup.
I mean, that room was super dull, except for the crooked lamp and the purple couch. And so we just set it up with that purple couch right in the room, and it's like in the center of this enormous room.
Yeah, it was great.
Fantastic.
And the other thing I was going to say on that setup is that I think it was a really professional setup in terms of how the result came out, but it was actually super easy to set up. It didn't take us long to put all that together.
And you were saying that the COBX supports both a V-mount for V-mount batteries, and then that also has an adapter for NPF batteries. And so you could have just slapped two NPFs on there and run it on battery only. And we weren't sure if we were going to have plug-in power. We ended up having plug-in power available. But it's really nice to have this super tiny light that can run on battery, and you can set up that interview setup anywhere that you need to, and you don't have to worry about finding plugs and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, I'm not saying it's the only light you need. It's nice having more power when you need it. And sometimes definitely, you do want, you know, a high wattage, full power thing. Having a larger softbox is always good, but I'm really excited about that light for doing portable interview stuff.
Oh, definitely. I also want to use it for maybe some lightning shots or maybe some accent lighting or that sort of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it uses the Aputure Citus Link app.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can control it from your phone. I have Aputure MCs that also work with that. And you can set up scenes with all those things.
You can sync them together, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so you can just control all of it. You can say, load the scene preset, and it'll load everything up. I mean, this is going to be so nice to have.
That makes me really mad. I'm just like super angry about that. I want to see it do the thing. I want to like set up all of the MCs and then just like make them lightning.
Yeah.
Or like, I don't know, different colors, or like red or I don't have enough ideas, but I just,
it sounds like you have enough ideas.
I think, I think that's why I'm so angry about it.
Yeah.
It's because I can't think of enough things to do with them, but there's so much potential.
The other thing that I liked about it, and one of the other uses I had in mind for it, is I do a lot of product shots, and sometimes it's great to have a top-down lighting for product shooting. And what's nice about that light is that it's so lightweight, I can easily put that on a C-stand and hang it over a table, and it's not, I'm not going to have any concerns about it tipping over or anything like that. So it's just... I'm really happy about that light.
So what you're saying is that it's not heavy.
It's not heavy.
It's light.
Oh, man. Come on. Come on.
Moving on. How much footage did we get?
Too much footage. just gonna say we got too much footage.
I feel like we're going to be able to make a lot of cool things out of what we shot.
Now, in fairness to us, we did an interview with three cameras, and the interview ended up being about 40 minutes, so it's probably too long. So that was a lot of footage, and then we also had two GoPros in the car that we ran basically the whole time during the race, so the whole first and second leg. So that by itself, just those GoPros, is about 2 hours of footage.
Yeah.
Because the race is approximately 30 minutes each way. We had two GoPros.
Yep.
So we had that working against us, but we still ended up with somewhere around 600 gigs of footage.
It's just, that feels so good.
And none of that's in ProRes. There's a lot of 4K 60, there's some 4K 120, and we shot it at, I think, around 200 megabits.
Yeah, well, most of it was 200 megabits.
Yeah, so it's good 4K, but it's not ProRes. And it's 600 gigs, so that's going to be a lot to go through.
And it's just going to be a blast.
Yeah.
We definitely want to talk about those GoPros more, probably not today, but they are the new GoPros, and so we got to play with those. And we're going to get a mess with the 10-bit color and just kind of see how that footage edits and grades and how well we can match it.
Yeah.
But we had those because, like I mentioned earlier, we couldn't be on course. And so what we were trying to do was get as much footage of the car moving and as much footage of the course itself so that we can edit that together with sound design and, you know, B-roll with the interview to make it feel like you're there in the car for the race. And so I was really happy that, you know, we were able to get the full race back and forth with the GoPros. And, you know, one of them did overheat on the way back. And I think that's because we left it in the car on the window while it was parked.
Yeah.
And so it heated up while it was just sitting there. But we got the GoPros inside, and then we also used them to get follow footage for tracking the car. And that was cool because we mounted it to the front sway bar of the truck, and then we mounted it to the hitch. And that front sway bar shot was really cool because we were like 6 inches, 8 inches off the ground. It might be higher, it might be 12. I don't know how much clearance that car has. Or the truck has, but, you know, 8 inches off the ground, mounted upside down, and then you get those tracking shots, it looked pretty sweet.
Yeah, all that footage worked out really well, and the GoPros were exactly the right tool for that job, both for inside the car and when we put them on the truck to get those shots. And so that was really satisfying because it felt like it was letting us capture stuff we could not otherwise get, because I don't think either of us were going to put our XH2S on the bottom of a truck going 60 down the highway. So it was nice.
There was
to have
discussion
that.
Of being in the back of the truck and then shooting the car that way. But I think that the GoPro was still a better option for those shots. It would have been nice to have those on like a tighter lens, but there's no way you'd get that shot stable.
That's the big thing. Not only are they more durable and smaller, but it was honestly mostly that stabilization, because we tried getting some shots where I was inside the truck shooting my camera through the windshield just to see what that would look like. And I mean, even with all of the IBIS on, it was just bouncing all over the place. But with the GoPro, it's like perfectly smooth. It's made for that.
Yeah, it's remarkable. The horizon lock was really cool as well. Not that we're talking about GoPros.
And I guess one thing on the gear, though, we had a couple of different mounts for the GoPros. We had a clamp mount, one that just kind of like a hose clamp, you know, that just clamps straight onto a bar, and then a suction cup. And I did actually really appreciate that we had a variety of those things, because I don't think we really knew what we needed going into it. And it was nice to have those different options available. We used all three of them.
We did.
In different cases. And so, you know, stuff like that, like you don't really think about it. You know, you think, I need to get the GoPro and maybe I need to get one mount for it. But having those different options, I feel like, kind of opened up some creativity.
Yeah, I feel like mounting gear and rigging gear is the unappreciated child of all the camera gear stuff that we talk about. Having those those little whatever, like super clamp things with the ball heads on them, and having, you know, C clamps and all the GoPro rigging equipment and gaff tape and all of these things really, really help. I didn't have like the right adapter for my mic mount for my shotgun, and I ended up having to tape it to a GorillaPod with gaff tape. And I was like, glad I had the gaff tape,
yeah,
because I didn't have the right other rigging equipment. And so just having all of the things and all of the extra things is always super nice. And just having the right thing when you need it to you know, jerry rig something together.
Yeah, it's like, it's not exciting to buy clamps, but there's some of the things I have that I'm just so happy I have. And I probably use some of those things more than gear mm-hmm. that I've spent a lot more money on. So I think it's yeah. worth buying.
Oh, definitely. I mean, whenever the situation arises and you realize that you have just enough gaff tape to handle it, that's
a good feeling.
Yeah, it's just about the same as getting a new camera. Yeah. So yeah. Equal feelings.
Equal feelings. One thing I wanted to go back to, you mentioned how much footage we got from this trip, and I thought it'd be interesting to talk about how we've dealt with that so far, and maybe a little bit about what we might be concerned about with the rest of the project, because I think that's an interesting challenge we have.
Yeah, definitely. So while we were on scene or whatever, while we were there shooting, we pulled footage every day. You pulled footage every time you took the drone into, or you swapped cards, basically. Every time you took the drone into the air, just by, you know, don't want to risk losing the drone and losing the footage.
Yep.
So we were as safe as we could as far as don't lose the SD card before you can pull the footage off. And then whenever we pulled it off, we each pulled from source. So you took a copy and I took a copy. And so we had copies of the footage from source on two separate computers.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were both backing that up to a T7. Like, so there was essentially six copies of the footage at any point during this whole event, so that if any of us lost anything, that we would have a backup.
Yeah, because copying from source is important, because you don't want to copy a file, have that be corrupted, and then all of your other copies are from that corrupted file. So that's kind of one point. And then the other thing is that one reason you want multiple copies of stuff is not just the footage getting corrupted or your hard drive crashing, but it's also theft. I mean, you know, you're in these situations with a lot of expensive gear, and sometimes you're leaving things in the car or whatever. And the more copies of it you have, the better chance you have that you're going to have one right. of those copies, you know, if something bad happens to your stuff.
One thing we didn't do was any sort of online or off-site backup of the footage. And maybe in retrospect, that's something to consider for next time, is to do an upload. But I mean, it's so much footage. And like you said, 600 gigs. I mean, that was over 3 days. I mean, there's no way on Airbnb Wi-Fi you're going to upload 200 gigs before you have to leave the next day.
Yeah, definitely not. I mean, you know, this was maybe a little bit lesser than what we would do in an extreme case, because we weren't being paid for this job.
Sure.
You know, if it was for a client, I think we'd do more. But I mean, for most things I do, I feel like my most extreme thing would be keeping that T7 in my pocket everywhere I go.
Right.
You know, have a copy at the Airbnb, have a copy in the car, have a copy in your pocket. And then, right. you know, it's like, how many things are going to have to go wrong to where you're going to lose all that footage? Like, mm-hmm. I guess if I get mugged and if the Airbnb and the car get broken into, like, I mean, at some point, you know, you can only reduce risk so much.
I think a lot of this is just good practice too. And a lot, and it was mostly underscored by that TV shoot that we did, where it's like, there's so much time, or this is a once in a life thing, or one opportunity, or even if you're shooting something at home, like you're spending your own time setting all this up and, you know, rigging out all whatever lighting and et cetera that you need, and then you're going to shoot it, and you don't want to have to then go back and reshoot those takes. And so even if it's like low stakes all the way up to high stakes, having good data management etiquette is critical.
Yeah. And I mean, the amount of trouble you're going to go through is kind of a sliding scale depending on the project.
Mm-hmm.
What we do for stuff we shoot at home is, you know, we're still backing it up, but we're definitely being a little less cautious than we are if we've set up an interview with somebody mm-hmm. or if we've gone to a location and spent money to get shots. You know, right. you have to decide what's appropriate for the situation. But
yeah,
backing up footage is critical, and you should never trust if you only have one copy of that footage.
Definitely. And I usually try to leave the footage on my cards until at least I've gone through the footage and I know I have two copies otherwise from the card. And that's burned me before, in that I've used image capture on my Mac to pull in footage, and anything over 4.29 gigs it doesn't copy.
Yeah, that's good to know.
Yeah, and so I've done that before, and I'm like, that's weird. Every time I try to render this file, Final Cut crashes, and I don't understand what's going on. And it was because it was missing half of the file, even though it had the right timestamp and the data, and just... I was like, oh, well, it's a good thing that I have this on these SD cards because I didn't clear the footage before I went through it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was going to say that too. When we were doing this throughout the shoot, I mean, we shot so much that I couldn't keep all the footage on my cards the whole time. But after I copied everything, I would play one or two files from that copied location. Mm-hmm. So every time I did that, I'd just check a couple of files and make sure that they actually copied properly. And I mean, that doesn't guarantee that there's no issues, but at least I know that there wasn't some catastrophic issue with the entire copy.
I know, like, no matter how careful I am, I still feel a little anxious every time I'm like on scene and I know I haven't gone through everything completely and I'm deleting something from source. When I'm like, well, I have to clear this SD card for tomorrow, and like, I know I copied it, but it's like 8 hours of footage and I'm not gonna watch all that footage. And I, like, yeah. I know I have two copies of it, but here we go. It's just.
Yeah, that's not a great feeling. I mean, I bought a couple of new SD cards for this trip.
Yep.
And I was glad I did, because that did give me the ability to eventually start not deleting cards. So when we started getting to the stuff that I felt like was really important, I stopped clearing the cards and I would just use a new card every time.
Yeah, it may be, you know, a little flippant, but for some cases when you're shooting something like this, or, you know, something that's more critical that you're getting paid for, it's almost like always bring enough media so that you don't have to delete until you know you have everything.
Yeah, I think there's an argument for that.
Yeah, the argument against it is CF Express cards are really expensive.
Yes, they are. I mean, if you're backing things up in multiple places, then I feel pretty good about that.
Right.
I will say the other good thing about going through your footage every day and backing it up as often as you can is that it does give you a chance to kind of evaluate what you're getting. And we did take advantage of that. So I was going through it every day and copying both of our cards to my T7. And I would just kind of glance through the clips and see what we got. And I was kind of able to identify on the second to last day that we didn't have very many establishing shots. We mentioned that earlier, kind of a lot of tight shots, not as many wide. And so it was good to be able to make those adjustments, you know, and we've got this problem. Let's find a way to deal with it. Let's get some more footage of these locations so that we can use it. And I think that's really valuable to do, not just what types of shots you're getting, but making sure your settings are good, making sure you had everything on the camera set the way you want. If you have the luxury of having a multi-day shoot, you got to take advantage of that. Like, you can,
oh, for
you
sure.
can make changes as you go.
Yeah, definitely. So let's talk a little bit more about that interview setup, or the portable interview setup. So we made the scene out of what we had. We used the natural lighting from the windows as fill so that we could have the background and any sort of edge lighting coming through from the sunlight, which is always a risk, especially whenever you go a little long, which we did, and the sun started setting. And so we lost, we went from zero on our exposure meter to negative 2/3 stops, almost one stop of light. So, like, we have enough latitude in the footage, but the light does dip slowly over time that we're going to, so we're going to mess with that. And then we talked about the aperture COB, and we set that up as our key light, and that worked out really, really well. And then we had three cameras set up. So for a 3-point interview shot, we shot the main straight on at 6.2K and just shot it full wide. And we shot that on the 17, but I think we shot it at like 20 millimeters. I kind of brought it in a little bit so that the frame was as square as we could get it.
Yeah, I hate shooting full wide for that reason.
Yeah, I would try really hard not to. Like, we had each of them basically at side of frame, and you don't want any distortion because we're going to crop in on that, and it doesn't have that like spherical look once you crop in. So we did that, and then we set up basically tight shots on each of them. So we shot it at 85 millimeter and I think 50 or 60 millimeter on the other one. Yeah. And I mean, that's basically all you need, right? It's like we mic'd each of them up with the DJI. And so we had lav mics for both. We had the shotgun mic as backup. And then we had the two tights on the wide. And we're going to be able to crop something together pretty quick.
Yeah. And we had kind of prepared a list of questions. And I just kind of went through those questions and got them to talk about things. And I mean, I haven't gone through all of it yet, but I think it went pretty well. And I mean, when we put this together, we're not going to play that whole interview. We're just going to take little bits and pieces of it, and most of it's going to just be the audio, and we're going to have other clips over it. But I'm really glad we have that, because if you ever have something that they're talking about that you don't have a good shot for, then you can always use that interview shot. So it's nice to have it. And I just think it makes for a better story to have them telling it rather than having a narrator or having a bunch of text on the screen or something like that.
So. Exactly. Yeah, we wanted to get everything as far as the story of the video spoken by them.
Yeah.
And I think our question list, you know, followed the story that you're trying to tell, and we covered basically everything that we needed. And it was really cool to be able to get a good looking interview set up out of just the gear that we brought with us, which wasn't much. And it kind of goes to show, like, it doesn't take a lot to get a decent setup for an interview. And sure, like, if you have more lighting and sound blankets and all this stuff, that you can make it better. But, you know, we did it in a carpeted room. We used the natural lighting that we had. We used the space to, you know, keep their shadows off the wall. And, you know, we did what we could with what we had, and it worked out pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, we would have done more if we were shooting it at one of our houses or something where we could take as much time as we wanted to stage the scene and all that. But, you know, sometimes I think it's better just to get what you can get. And, you know, kind of the same principles of, like, we don't want to be the one that everybody's waiting on and don't want to have tons and tons of gear that we're trying to bring and all that. And so I think it worked out really well.
Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about the shoot? I mean, I think it went pretty well. I had a lot of fun, and, you know, we got a lot of really cool drone shots, and the GoPro footage was neat, and I'm really excited to see what we edit together.
Yeah, I think it did go really well. I mean, I'm a little bit worried about how we're going to edit it with 600 gigs of raw video. I mean, it's just going to be hard to, I mean, my laptop only has a 1 terabyte hard drive, so I think maybe in a future episode, we'll talk a little bit about how we deal with that and some of that workflow. I think that'd be good. But yeah, I mean, overall, I really enjoyed it. And I mean, you've got to do projects like this, right? Like, this is a growing thing for us. I mean, we wanted to do it to kind of create a memory for the guy that was doing the race, but it's also a really good experience for us. And it's a big project we can work on. And yeah. I mean, that's how you get better, right? Like, you go out and you shoot stuff. And so I'm proud of us for identifying this as a good opportunity and planning it and putting it together and going and doing it. And
I think it's going to be a really nice final product too. And should be able to, you know, use it as a pitch for other people.
Yeah.
But we shot most of this in F-Log 2. And I'm expecting to do most of our color grading for the final project. And I'm really excited to finally get a lot of footage to go through and really fine tune what the capabilities are of that profile.
Yeah.
I mean, so far from the last interview that we shot in F-Log, the colors and the dynamic range are fantastic out of that profile from what I could tell. But what it did mean is that we were shooting everything at 1250 ISO and Eric, you talk about APS-C and crop factor and needing more light, you know, all the time. And we shot a lot of stuff outside. And when you're shooting at 1250 ISO outside, it doesn't matter how small your sensor is. There's just so much light. And we brought NDs, but we didn't bring nearly enough ND.
Yeah. Yeah. You think like, oh yeah, I need a little bit of ND. It's going to be bright out there. But I completely forgot that we were going to have to shoot 1250 ISO.
And yeah.
It was a huge problem.
I was messing with it and like exposing for, you know, something not in the shade. And we needed like 6 stops of ND in order to get it back to just 0. It's cool in that, you know, you can shoot F-Log 2, you know, plus 3 stops before it starts clipping, you know, in broad daylight, you know, compared to what you're shooting at. There's so much latitude and there's so much dynamic range. So you can only shoot F-Log 2 and 14-bit readout at under 30 frames per second because of, you know, needing, you know, speed to pull off the sensor and all that data. And so whenever I was switching between 4K 60 and 4K 24, it was going between 12-bit readout and 14-bit readout for the dynamic range. And you could totally tell because I had my Zebra set at 80% and it wouldn't be clipping at 24 frames per second. And when I flipped it over to 60, it was clipping.
Yeah, it was really interesting to see that. I mean, mm-hmm. It was like you flipped that one preset dial on your camera and it's like clipping, not clipping. I didn't expect that to be as apparent as it was.
Yeah, and that was even with me, you know, breaking some rules and shooting at like 1 over 96 for 24 and then shooting, you know, 1 over 120 for, mm-hmm. you know, 60 frames per second. And even then with like, I was getting the, you know, less light with the frames per second bump and still clipping when going down 12 bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess just to briefly mention, the reason we care so much about ND filters with this is, you know, for photography, it doesn't really matter. You just turn the shutter up until whatever you need it to be at. But for video, you really want to have that 180 degree shutter angle where your shutter is, you know, twice as fast as your frame rate. So 1/60 if you're shooting 30 frames per second or whatever. And you want that because that gives you more natural motion blur.
Right.
And you can tell when you look at video. You can tell if it was shot with a 180 degree shutter or not, at least at lower frame rates. It matters a little bit less at higher frame rates.
Right.
But yeah, we were having to break that rule a little bit because we just didn't have enough ND. I mean, ideally 24 frames per second, you'd want to have your shutter at 1/48. But most of the stuff we were doing in the middle of the day, there's no way I could have shot at 1/48.
Yeah, there's no way. And if it didn't have too much fast motion, you can kind of get away with it without people noticing. And it'll be fine for a lot of the B-roll stuff that we shot. But
fortunately, though, we were at a race.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, you know, people like someone waving their arms where like you're getting that natural blur versus like a car that's driving by. You may get the wheels turning could look strange if you shoot at too high of a frame rate.
Right.
But I mean, I don't think we ever shot so high that it was a problem. We weren't shooting like 1/500, which would have looked insane. I mean, the highest I went on 24 was like 1/96.
Yeah, yeah. Regardless, we didn't have enough ND. And personally, I thought I was going to have enough because I bought an ND4 filter. And so I thought, this is four stops of ND. That's a lot. Like, that's got to be enough, right? But it turns out that's not really how that works.
Yeah, I thought I knew everything there was to know about ND until this trip. And then I was looking into it and I was like, oh, so like an ND64 isn't a 64 stop ND, because that would be insane.
It kind of makes sense when you say it out loud, but I think we both thought like that's a lot of ND.
Yeah, but no, like, so I knew it wasn't 64 stops, but like I don't really know what that means. And so I was looking it up, and like, you know, when you're talking about light, if you half the distance to a light, you double the intensity, you double the stops. So like if you're 2 feet from a light and you go to 1 foot, you've added one stop of light. And so because of that square law, they rate NDs by power, by, you know, 2^(of). So 2^(1) is 2. So an ND2 is 1 stop. 2^(4) is 16. So an ND16 is 4 stops.
Yeah. Which is a lot smaller than it sounds. You hear ND16 and that sounds like so much, but it's really not.
They never tell you that whenever you get into videography and photos and stuff that you're going to have to know so much math.
Yeah.
And you have to like, oh, well, what's double my frame rate over 2?
Yeah, multiplying by 2. That's pretty hard.
Oh, and what's this is an ND256. What is 2^(what) to equal this? And now, now I'm doing exponential algebra and I just wanted to take a picture.
Yeah, that was surprising. And I guess the other part of this is, you know, a lot of times in the past, I've used variable ND filters, which is nice because you get a range of ND and you just turn the front of it and it changes how much you get. And, you know, in hindsight, I probably would have been better off with that because I probably would have had some sort of range. You know, my ND4 was basically a 2-stop ND filter. Mm-hmm. Most variable NDs would give you a little bit more than that.
Yeah. And variable NDs are tricky in that, you know, you can go buy a K&F variable ND for $40, and it's essentially two polarizers that are opposite of each other, and then you turn the two polarizers to darken it, and they work okay in the middle stop range, but once you get it to the extreme end or the light end, and those polarizing angles are minute compared to each other, then like you can get weird color shifts and weird vignetting. And if you want your footage to look as good as possible, you kind of are doing yourself a favor in shooting with a fixed ND over something that's variable, unless you have a really nice variable ND isn't using those polarizing effects.
Yeah, I think you can get variable NDs that are good enough, but they're just so expensive.
They are.
And I mean, end of the day, you've got more glass between you and the light, and that's not ideal.
Right.
So I had thought, you know, I'm going to use a fixed ND, but I also don't want to have to buy a zillion ND filters. And every lens has a different filter size, you know? And so what do you do? My bright idea, was to get a 72 millimeter ND filter.
That was a pretty good one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You like that? So my idea was to get a 72 millimeter ND filter, which fits on my largest lens, which is the Fuji 50-140. And then I'd get a 67-72 step-up ring so that I could use that same ND filter on my Tamron 17-70. And so that works great, except for two problems I noticed. And the first one is that both these lenses have a lens hood. And it's nice using the lens hood. You get a little bit less glare on the lens, and it also kind of protects the front of the lens.
Yeah, you don't look as cool as if you were using a full-on matte box, but
you still look a little cool.
You still look a little cool. Your lens looks a little longer.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Longer the lens, closer to God, and it keeps the sheen of the sun off of it, and so you have more contrast.
Yeah, and so it's better to use those. And it worked great on the 50-140 because 72 millimeter lens, 72 millimeter filter, and the lens hood is made for that. But the problem that I ran into is that on that Tamron 17-70, that lens is a 67 millimeter lens. And when I put that step up ring on there, all of a sudden that filter is wider than the lens,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't get the lens hood on there. So that was a little bit frustrating.
Yeah, that is certainly frustrating. I think that what I wish I had had going into this was an ND256, which would be 8 stops, and then maybe a 64 and a 4 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Something basically like 2, 4, and 8 stops of light, and then you can kind of stack them. I would not recommend stacking more than 2 NDs on top of each other, because then you start getting into the angle of the lens.
Yeah, you get a little bit of vignetting on the edge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, in hindsight, I definitely would have wanted an 8 stop, and then if I needed more light, I could just adjust in that way.
Yeah.
The other thing we didn't mention is that we were both shooting at pretty small apertures, again, to try and control the light.
I shot a lot at f9, f11. I was trying not to shoot, like, you know, above f11, just because, you know, that's your sharpest point of the lens, and then especially with zooms, once you start getting into that f18, f22, sure, even more is in your depth of field. But the diffraction of the light, it starts getting soft again.
It's so frustrating because cinematic type footage, you want to have some low depth of field stuff,
yep.
and it looks really artsy, but just couldn't shoot at that. I mean, at night I was, but mm-hmm. but during the day I had to shoot it.
Honestly, when I wanted to get those shots, I shot them in 120 and I just cranked my shutter and was like, YOLO, I'm getting this shot. And it's just going to have to work.
Moral of the story, you probably need more ND than you think you do mm-hmm. if you're shooting in a log profile. Because
oh
all
gosh.
Log profiles do this.
Yeah. Like the full frame ones aren't that bad. I think that the base ISO on like an A7 IV is maybe like 500 or 640 or something.
Yeah, but I mean, you still have to keep in mind that that's limiting you a lot. Because normally you can get those cameras down to 100 ISO maybe.
Yeah,
you know?
And so it's still 2 stops or more over whatever your base is.
Yeah.
And for the Fuji, I mean, shooting at 1250, that's like 4 or 5 stops over, you know, shooting at 100.
Knowing that, like, I need to go buy some new ND filters because I want to have more than I need.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And shooting in the Texas sun is, you know, 8 stops just to get to bare minimum when shooting. Like, if you're going to shoot f4,
yeah,
you know, in f-log 2, yeah, you need so much ND.
And I mean, some of that too is kind of going back to this style of shooting. You know, if we were shooting a film or a narrative project of any kind, you know, we could pick the situation.
We could
pick the lighting. We would shoot more at golden hour. You know, you wouldn't have these problems quite
as much.
Yeah, you're
setting the time, setting the scene, all of that.
Setting the direction of the camera. But
mm-hmm.
with this kind of stuff, things are happening. You need to capture them. You know, it's going to be the middle of the day and the sun's going to be really bright. And sometimes you have to shoot toward the sun. And so you just have to be ready for anything.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. Man, it's hard to be prepared. I feel like we brought a lot of stuff. We didn't use all of it, and then there was some stuff that we didn't need, and I was like, what if I emergency bought more ND and had Amazon ship it to me tomorrow? But we were in West Texas, and that wasn't going
to
happen.
There's no way they had Amazon out there.
Yeah, it's like you can't always rely on being able to get what you need on site, but like you don't want to overpack, and so this stuff can be pretty tricky. But once kind of you do it more, you get a better grasp for like what you're actually going to use.
I mean, I felt like we did pretty well with what we brought. I feel like we probably shot too much. We probably should not have had as much footage from this.
I think we should have had more footage.
You know, you say that. You're not doing the rough editing. But I'll cut us some slack on that. You know, we don't know exactly how this is going to look when it comes out, and you just kind of want to capture what you can when you can get it. But that aside, I mean, I feel like we pretty much picked the right set of gear. We had a couple of things we didn't use. We had some spares, which I was happy we had. And besides the things that we should have had more of, I mean, I didn't feel overloaded, I guess, for what I ended up using.
Yeah, I was definitely happy with that. One more thing on the footage. I mean, this is a matter of if we had been able to plan more ahead of time, or if we had had a shorter delivery window. And our delivery window for this is we're shooting for end of the year, so we still have, you know, a few months to put this together. Versus if we were trying to deliver this in 2 weeks, then we would have taken more time planning and therefore shot less footage, which seems counterintuitive, but we would essentially have shot the edit. Yeah. That way you wouldn't have had so much footage to go through. But because we have the affordance of a little more time on the back end, we were able to overshoot, and then that gave us spare footage for, you know, other future projects or other, you know, different takes of the video, and then additionally, you know, to provide what were our main documentary that we're putting out.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point. And that'd be a good topic for us to talk about at some point. How can you go in and shoot something and get multiple videos out of it? Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of an interesting topic. Yeah. But I wish we had been able to shoot the edit a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you live and learn. I think we'll maybe do a little bit better next time. And if you don't know what the final thing's going to look like, then your only choice is to get as much as you can and go from there.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. Every time I think about shooting the edit, I think about Sam Raimi and his style of shooting. And for a lot of his early films, he knew that the Hollywood, you know, bigwigs were going to, there's always a risk of, like, you know, you shoot for coverage and, like, you shoot a bunch of different angles of one scene, have everybody act it out, and then you essentially edit the whole thing in post, and, like, the director doesn't get any say, like, as far as, like, what they cut and what they show and which ones are what. And so what Sam Raimi would do is he would shoot the edit, and he'd be like, this next scene is going to be this one little bit, and I'm going to shoot, you know, you taking your gun out of this holster for 10 seconds at this angle, and now we're going to go shoot the next thing. And so he, like, didn't give them the option. He basically shot exactly what the film was going to be and was like, here, take this footage and put it in order and we're done.
You've got to really know what you're doing.
Yeah, you do.
Because the problem I run into a lot is, you know, I get angles I'm happy with, but my clips are never long enough.
Right.
I always wish I had the record button pressed for twice as long as I did.
Yeah, always.
And you've really got to be confident if you're just going to shoot mm-hmm. exactly what you need.
But that's where it comes into planning. The more you plan, the more space you can save and then time you can save on the edit.
Yeah, that's a good lesson that we are going to learn the hard way.
I mean, and it's honestly, it's something that you can only learn by doing. And, like, the more projects that you work on and the more things that you put together, the better you're going to get at knowing exactly what you need, so that you're not overdoing it. I'm really looking forward to this, to, you know, seeing the final version of this project.
Yeah, I think what we've done so far is good. I'm really happy that we've done it. And then, yeah, I can't wait to see how it comes out.
Cool.
Well, do we have anything else to talk about today?
I don't know. I feel like that's really mostly what I wanted to cover. And maybe next time we can get into those GoPro 11s, Black Hero Pro Maxes. And you know, dig into maybe some of the issues and things that we had.
Yeah, I think we've got a lot of opinions on those GoPros, but we'll save that for next time. That's going to do it for the show today. Thanks for joining us. And if you enjoyed it, we'd encourage you to rate us on iTunes and tell your photography friends about the show. Also, check out our website at cameragearpodcast.com to learn more or send us feedback and questions. We'll be back with more next week.